You have such an introduction.
The only thing that was missing here is my mother, because she's the only one who believes it. And I got to tell you, she knows me, so she doesn't really believe it either. So, but thank you very much for your kind words. Thank you very much for opening your home. It's a pleasure to be here. It's nice to meet you. It's difficult in these situations where I'm just new, and I haven't met you before. It's nice to be able to get a sense of who you are, what you are, and it's easier to relate. So you'll forgive me. It will be a little bit more general than it will be personal. I don't know if you've heard of Rabbi Mordechai Becher. Have you heard of Rabbi Mordechai Becher?
Yeah. He spoke for us 13 times.
13 times. I got a lot of catching up to do. So he coined a phrase called getting bageled. You know what getting bageled means? You ever been in Costco and the guy behind the counter says, goes, Shalom? Like, I know that you're Jewish. It's called getting bageled. I get bageled all the time. But I once got baba ganoush. I'll tell you what happened. I was in Norfolk, Virginia with my son, and we were waiting in line in the post office. The only thing worse than the post office is the DMV, right? Because you have the counters with all these people. And there's one lady sitting behind there because everybody else is on lunch. It doesn't make a difference, 9 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, somebody is on lunch. And it's a long line. It was a major post office. It was actually right next to our shoulder. And the line was forming, and I was waiting and waiting with my son. And I just had this thing that I think we were buying stamps for some sort of a simcha. It might have been bar mitzvah. It might have been a, I don't know what it was. But we were waiting a long time. And we're waiting, and this lady, who's sitting in the back of the line, goes out of line, and she goes like this. She gives me the once-over, but not like even being subtle. She walks back. She comes back again, it wasn't enough, and she looks at me again, and she goes... Anyway, after about 5 minutes, she looks at me, and she says, are you Muslim? Am I Muslim? I look Muslim.
Yeah,
it's the hat. I had my big white one on. I wasn't sporting a mustache at the time, so I'm kidding. I obviously don't look Muslim, but you Muslim. So I said, no. So I'll just say it in the way that she said it to me, because it has been I think it has a stronger effect. But she looks at me, she goes, so who'd you be? So I said, I really didn't want the conversation. I was waiting to get my stamp, you know. But so I said, what do you mean? What do you mean? He said, well, who are you? She said, you're not Muslim. I said, yeah, I'm Jewish. Ah. She goes back to her place in line. She comes back a little bit, to me it seemed, I don't know, it was some time there. She comes back and says, what's that? So I said, what's that? She says, yeah, like how's that any different? So I said, oh no, she said, what is that? So I said to her, well, you know, we believe God created the heaven and earth in 6 days, rested on the Sabbath, he gave us the Torah, and we had revelation, mass revelation at Sinai, and we observed, you know, the Ten Commandments and the rest of the Holy Book. She goes, so how's that any different? How's that any different? So I said, how's that any different? I said, okay, let's just do it. I said, we don't believe in Jesus. So she goes, you're going to hell. So that was really the story. I thought it was kind of funny at the time. But when I came back home, I was thinking about the conversation. And I thought, in all of her confusion, she asked a very important question. And that question is, who'd you be? We'll translate that. Who are you? What are you? I think that's a question that everybody's got to ask themselves. Who are you? How do you arrive at who you are? What decisions do you make that cause you to be who you are? How do you prioritize? How do you decide what's right? How do you decide what's wrong? What sort of a legacy do you want to leave? You know, today, Baruch Hashem, my wife and I are blessed with 4 grandchildren. And I just want to make them proud. I want them to look at their Zadie and say, oh, that's my Zadie. That's really what I'm trying to do. But how do I define that? How do you define making your grandchildren proud? Making your children proud? How How do you define that? How do we decide what's right? How do we decide what's wrong? What's this legacy going to look like? I think that's a very important question. And it's gotten muddled over the years in a terrible way. Because over the years of many different reasons, but some of the reasons have to do with anti-Semitism and the persecution that the Jewish people have suffered. And the modern American Jew today doesn't really define or answer the question, who'd you be, the way that maybe his great-grandparents or her great-grandparents would have defined that. And if you take it back centuries or even millennia, you know, for some of us today, if Maimonides walked into the room today, he would recognize us and would say, oh, that's Ken Simon-Mein-Ankel. Right? That could, probably didn't say that, he was Sparty. But he said, that could be, but we speak Yiddish a little bit here?
Yes.
Okay, good. Now I feel at home. So he would say, I see that, I can recognize him, I can recognize her. But there are many people where maybe Maimonides was walking today and wouldn't recognize them. Why? How did that happen? How did Jewish people stop thinking like Jews? Well, it had a lot to do with persecution. It had a lot to do with anti-Semitism. I mean, Jews, all we want when you're running for your life at all times, and, you know, the fact that I hate even to open up my mouth, but the rise of anti-Semitic instances that's happening recently is very scary. But it's not something that we should be surprised about. You take a look at Jewish history, not 50 years went by without very difficult tragedy. We live in this beautiful country, a country of chesed, a country of kindness, but we weren't always so lucky. We were running for our lives. Jews couldn't own land. Jews couldn't own businesses. You know, in the Arab countries, it was really bad. In Christian countries, it might even have been worse. In the Arab countries, there was something called dhimmi. You could exist. They had a relationship. They had an agreement with their Arab hosts. If you bow and you make yourself subservient to your Arab host, so we'll tolerate you. They made them wear funny hats. Jews always managed to take those things that were supposed to degrade them and make them to a badge of honor. The fezes that the Jewish community wears was supposed to be like a dunce cap in Morocco. So all the important people wear that hat today because they made it into something special. But it was persecution, and there was no, in terms of any sort of judicial recourse, didn't exist. How are you supposed to get up and testify against an Arab who hurt you? And in the Christian world, you know, today, Christianity has definitely become a religion of peace. It wasn't like that for 1600 years. You all know about the First Crusade and the Second Crusade and the Khomeinsky riots and the pogroms of 1648 and 1649. We can go on and on and on. It did not. So when you're persecuted like that, you just want to get out of persecution. And when you want to get out of persecution, you look at the freedom around you and say, oh, that's what I want. I want freedom. I want to own my business. And then all of a sudden, you know, in the 1812 comes along the French Revolution, and that opened up the doors for a lot of the Jewish community. Then you have movements of the Jewish people trying to become more like their hosts, because they feel, as Jews, they don't like us. The more we try to be like the non-Jews, maybe that will change their opinion of us. You know, Herzl said, before he came up with his magnificent idea of a Jewish state, the year was 1898, and he stood up at the first Zionist conference and he said, you know, today I have founded the Jewish state. It'll take 50 years to realize, but today we have found the Jewish state. It was prophetic. He was no prophet, because 15 years earlier he was writing in the Austrian papers that the only solution for the Jewish problem is for everyone to become baptized. He wrote that. That was his solution, it wasn't a difficult conclusion to arrive at, right? Why? Because they didn't suffer persecution. We suffered persecution. So what has happened is over the years, a lot of that thinking has crept into our psyche. And we make decisions based upon things that make us feel more comfortable, based upon things that very emotional decisions, not necessarily logical decisions, but emotional decisions, what we want the Jewish people to be, free, and have, but what's happened is we've eroded away at Judaism because of it. So there's a question. The question is, who'd you be? Right? Who are we? How do we make those decisions? How do we come? What kind of a legacy do we want to leave? And what happens is that over the years, and I just picked one example, but it's a very good example, has a lot to do with it, the anti-Semitism and the persecution that we have endured has changed the way that we think. Changed the way that we think. You know, at the beginning of the state, they figured that the solution to the Jewish problem would be, you know, we have a flag, we have a language, we have a national anthem, we'll have an Olympic team, we'll be like everybody else. It just infuriates them more. Actually, this is not a new solution. In the time of Cheskel HaNovi, the Jewish people said, "Kechol Hagoyim Beis Yisrael." We want to be like all the nations. And the prophet said, "In the name of God, Hoyoloyia Dover Azeh." Ain't going to happen. It's not going to happen. That's not the Jewish people. But that's a natural solution. And what's happened is the decisions that we make and the conclusions that we arrive at are very often based upon that. You know, there's a interesting Gemara. It's a Gemara in Zvachim. The Gemara says that let's just start off like this. The Chofetz Chaim said that communism is going to last for 70 years and it's going to end without a war.
Wow.
Chofetz Chaim said that. 70 years and it's going to end without a war. Wow. So they asked him, how do you know that? How do you know that? So he says it's a Gemara in Zvachim. The Gemara says that Echad Meshivim Shana, says every 70 years, there is a star that arises in the heavens that is there to cause the sailor, to misguide the sailors. I'm not getting to the whys. That's what happens. Every 70 years, there's some sort of a star, and if we follow that star, it's a mistake. And the goal is to know that it's a mistake and not follow that star. Every 70 years, there's another star. He says, this is the star of our generation. Communism is going to last for 70 years. Because communism doesn't make sense, right? It was supposed to be that panacea. It was going to be the solution to all of our problems. And more people were killed in the name of communism than any other ism ever. 150 million people were killed because of communism. Stalin had a big portion of that himself. 70 years is going to end without a war. So a number of years ago, it must have been at least 30 years, because the story is about Rabbi Yisrael Kuttner, who died in 1982. Chof Kislev, right? We just celebrated his 32nd anniversary of his death. He said, he was asked a question. He said, okay, what is the star of our generation? What is that concept that sends the Jewish people off the rails? What causes the Jewish people to make a mistake? And he said, you know what it is? It's that Jewish people have come to a point today that they don't realize that there's a difference between a Jew and a non-Jew. That's not a judgment. I'm not making judgment what is better, what's not better. That's not the point. But there's a difference. There's a difference. And a lot of that difference has played a role in how our thinking has evolved. There is actually at the Medrash, at the beginning of the portion of Vayikra, the Medrash says that describes the difference between the Jewish people's relationship with the Almighty and the nations of the world. And the Medrash says that when the Almighty comes to Jewish prophets, he even comes during the day, whereas to non-Jewish prophets, he'll only come at night. And the Medrash goes on to explain why. He says, because at night, it's a time when people are separate from each other, but during the day, it's a time when people are close together. So there are those who explain this in Medrash, a very interesting Medrash as follows. That the uniqueness of Judaism is that we have the ability to take everything that is physical and make it into a holy pursuit. Whereas the highest level of Christianity, of Buddhism, of Islam, the only way that you can reach the highest echelons is if you separate yourself from the physical world. It has to be an ascetic lifestyle. Catholicism, at least what they claim on the outside, who knows what's going on the inside, but on the outside, you have to take vows of poverty and take vows of chastity. They have to separate themselves from the physical world. Buddhism, Hare Krishnas, all the higher you get, the more you have to separate yourself from physicality, to the point where they almost don't even wear clothes. Why don't they wear clothes? It's not immodest, because they have to separate themselves from the physical world. They don't have the understanding of how to utilize this world as a spiritual pursuit. How does that happen? What's the difference? That's the reason why the Almighty can only come to the non-Jews at night. A night is a time that we're separate. It's a time where people are separate. Today we really don't have extreme night anymore. Night, at one time, was really, really nice. I used to tell this to my kids. When we lived in Norfolk, often we would go to Williamsburg, not the one in Brooklyn. They all wear the white socks, the knee socks, but it's just in the same hats, actually, in the same long coats, just a little bit of a different place. Have you ever been there, to Williamsburg, Old Williamsburg? It's a very, very interesting place. But we would go there, and we'd walk down the streets, and I would tell my kids, do you realize if this would be back in like 1800, or late 1700, you wouldn't be able to see a darn thing. You know, the lantern that they would walk around with, that was their source of light at night. It was candles. It was very dim. You didn't have the light that we have the ability to take night and make it into day. It's an amazing thing. But real night, there's separation. There's separation from things. There's separation from people. When they are totally separated from the physical world, that's when they can experience the Almighty. The Jewish people, on the other hand, we can experience even when it is broad daylight. We can take a palm frond and we can make it into a holy object. We can take parchment, make it into a holy object. We can take food, we can make it into a holy object. We can take physical actions, the most intimate of actions, make it into a spiritual and a holy pursuit. We have the ability. How do we do that? How do we know how to do that? We know how to do that because we receive direction from above. We place ourselves under our God. It's interesting, this past week's parsha, I just thought of it. This past week's portion, we know that Paro tells Yosef about his dream. But you know, if you look at the verses, you'll see there is a difference between the way that he related it to his magicians and the way that he related it to Yosef. When he said to his magicians, he said, I was hovering, floating over the lake, over the swamp. Most, when he spoke to Yosef, he said, I was standing on the edge. And the Medrash Rabbah says, you know why? Because the nations of the world, they put themselves over their gods, where the Jewish people who were standing on the banks, we put ourselves under our gods. What does that mean? It means that we, as Reb Samson Raphael Hirsch said, other religions were created by man to define God. Judaism was created by God to define man. We have instruction. We have direction. We know how to utilize things because the Almighty teaches us, I created this for this purpose. You want to get pleasure out of this world? You really want to understand what this world is? This is my Torah. You know, there was a guy who was in the 70s, he was touring around Israel, and he came from a very secular American background. And somehow he ended up by the Wailing Wall, by the Kotel, and there was somebody over there who wanted to bring him in to meet a rabbi. The rabbi's name was Rabbi Noach Weinberg. The rabbi, a blessed memory, who Eisha Torah. And he said, Rabbi, the rabbi said to him, what do you think of Israel? He says, you know, Rabbi, I've toured all of Israel, from the Tula down to Eilat, from the Dead Sea all the way to the Mediterranean. I went all over the place, and I haven't seen any holiness. nothing holy. So Rabbi Weinberg scratches his beard, and he looks at him and says, really? But I'm sure you saw some bafos. The guy says, what? Bafostik? You didn't see any bafostik? This is Israel. Bafostik's all over the place. You saw bafostik. So the guy says, Rabbi, what's bafostik? He says to my dear son, what's holiness? If you don't know what you're looking for, how can you find it? The Almighty has given us a key. He's given us a map. He's given us the ability for holiness. What does holiness mean? So, if you look at the nations of the world, holiness means long robes. Holiness means living an ascetic lifestyle. Holiness means separating yourself from the physical world completely. But if you take a look at our Torah, you'll see it's a little bit different. It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Almighty, showing us how to utilize every breath of life that we have for a holy pursuit. We can take something and we can make it special when you're using your own set of values, when we're getting the values that are more comfortable, that are easy, the values that we have fallen into over the last 2,000 years because of the difficulties that we have experienced. Those values are values that are self-aggrandizement. They don't know what to do with the physical world. They don't know how to pursue true holiness. They're creating it themselves. We have a message from a different place. It's not our own understanding. God, when He created the world, He gave us a map. He said, this is the world that I'm giving you, and this is how to use it. When you want to create a legacy, you want the next generation to look back, I mean, I do, and be proud of the things that we're doing. How do we define that? We need to learn how not to be selfish. Not to be selfish means to be übergegeben. In Yiddish, you say übergegeben. It means you are completely give yourself over for somebody else. Give yourself over for somebody else. It's so interesting. This year, amazing thing happened. We all know that it was the 80th year since Kristallnacht. This year. So, there were these pictures, I'm sure you've all seen it, by the Brandenburg Gate. Chabad erected a menorah. And the president of Germany called up Rabbi Tachtel, who is the Chabad Shaliach for Germany, the head Chabad guy there, said to him, I want to light the menorah. Can you imagine? You see the picture. I saw these pictures. It's amazing. The Brandenburg Gate, where you have these huge, long Nazi flags hanging, and underneath it you have this Chabad rabbi sitting there with the president and a menorah underneath. If that's not a miracle, I don't know what is. But the guy had a problem, the rabbi, because he wanted to light the menorah. We have to light the menorah, right? How's he going to get these non-Jewish? How's he going to get them to light the menorah? So he tells them a very true statement. He said, Mr. President, you're going to have the honor of lighting the shamash.
How smart.
You know why that's such an honor? Because that with that one candle, we light all the other candles. But I think that there's another message in there. Not that he was telling this necessarily to the German president, but he was the shamash. How do we create light? How do we create holiness? By totally being given over, übergegeben to somebody else. Very often, when one appears to be somebody, and it's you know, we're talking big generalities, there are always going to be exceptions, but it's very self-serving. It's the way that I see kindness, the way I see giving over, being able to help people, to build people up. It really boils down to being about me. How can one be in a way where you can totally remove self? The only thing to do that was Torah. There was a very holy, great rabbi who lived in B'nai Brak, really the leader of Torah Jewry for many years, and his name was Reb Lazer Shach. I could tell you so many stories you wouldn't even believe that if I shouldn't have told you who the rabbi was first. If I told you the stories, and I would have asked you to guess who the rabbi was, you never would have guessed. Such holiness, this person. But I just heard a story recently. I just popped into my head. I think I want to share it with you. There is a certain yeshiva, well, it's a number of years since his passing, but there's a yeshiva in Bnei Brak. And the rabbi asked one of his gabbayim, one of the people who help him, assistants, to call this and this rabbi. His name is Rabbi Katzenstein. I need to speak to him. So Rabbi Katzenstein, who was a young guy at the time in his late 20s, gets this message that this grand rabbi needs to speak to him, so he goes running. And he's wondering to himself, like, what could he possibly be thinking? Like, why does he need to speak to me? So he says, you know, he comes in there and he says, listen, there is this boy in your class, correct? And his name is such and such. I forgot the name. He says, yeah, it's true. He says, I'm going to pay you every month so that you can find an older student, actually a married kollel guy, a talented person who will be there to help this boy. Okay. Why? He said, it doesn't make a difference. But we have to do this with one condition. You can never tell anybody that I'm the one doing this. It's a long story. I'm going to make it quick. Basically, there was one month where he went to collect his money from Rabbi Shach, and Rabbi Shach was there, but he was meeting with somebody, and the guy had to get back to his next lesson, so he ran back quickly, and he wasn't able to pick up his money. Meanwhile, this guy was waiting. He gets a knock on his door later on that evening. Rabbi Shach is standing there by his door. He said, where were you? I needed to pay you. You were supposed to come. I was supposed to give you the money. The guy says, but you should excuse me, Yeshiva. You know, I was there, but I saw you were meeting with somebody, so I went back. I had to go back to the yeshiva. Oh, Rabbi Shach, I'm so sorry. Unbelievable. It's right. You were there. He says, I caused you so much bittel zman. I wasted your time. What can I give you for the time that I wasted? So the guy says, you know what? I'll tell you what you can give me. An explanation why this kid. What's so special about this kid? We have many kids in the school. Many kids who could use that kind of help. It's true, he's an average kid. Not too dumb, not too smart, right in the middle. He has grown tremendously since he started learning with this guy. Why this kid? So Ashok says, okay, I will tell you on one condition. That you can't tell anyone this story as long as I'm alive. This is the story. He said, for many years I studied in Slabodsky Yeshiva. He said, in Slabodsky Yeshiva, in the morning they would have a piece of bread. In the evening they would get a piece of bread, one piece. And in the afternoon they would eat something called teg. That means the people of the community were kind enough to open up their homes and people would come in to eat. And, you know, they would give them to eat, like they would have lunch program. That they would give people. He said, I was a shy kid. I was embarrassed to do it. I never ate in the afternoon. Shabbos, I had to eat, so I would have to go to the place where they assigned me, but I was so embarrassed to go to eat at people's houses, I never went. He says, at night, he said, I didn't sleep at people's houses either. I was embarrassed. I slept in Slabodka. He said, I had one shirt, and every Erev Shabbos, every Friday, I would go down to the river there by Slabodka, and I had a little bit of soap, and I would wash that shirt, L'Kavod Shabbos, and for the honor of the Shabbos, and when it was drying, I'd have it on a rock over there, I'd have a book. And I opened up the book and I would study, and when it would dry, I put it on. It was the one shirt that I had. He says, I didn't have pajamas. I didn't have a blanket. I slept on the benches of Slabodka for 10 years. So, he said, one Friday afternoon, I'm sitting there by the river, and this lady comes over and she starts screaming at me, you're a yeshiva student? What kind of an embarrassment is this of the Torah that you sit here with a torn shirt? You have rips here and rips there. He says, you know, I'm so sorry. He says, you know, you're right, but it's my only shirt. I don't have anything. She says, it's your only shirt? Can't be. She walked away. Later on that afternoon, she came back with two shirts. She said, this is one for Shabbos, and this is one for the weekday. Two shirts. He says, because a Torah student has to represent the Torah, can't walk around with a ripped shirt. She comes back, and so what happened, they parted ways. Unfortunately, she and her entire family were destroyed, except for one grandson. owe her, Curtis, I tell you, I owe her gratitude. He said, you think it was easy for me to find her? It was easy for me to find this kid. But I found her, and it's the least that I can do. But you can never tell anyone until he says, as long as I'm alive. To me, that's greatness. The appreciation, to have such appreciation that you spend years searching for a way to be able to pay back. Where does that come from? Most people will give up. Most people, gratitude? Okay, I wanted to have gratitude, but I tried. To continue to pursue and find and show that gratitude, to me, that's greatness. That only comes from a person who is selfless. A person who is looking for a higher direction. A person who is willing to negate, use themselves as a vessel to bring about honor to the Almighty's name. When I was in Phoenix, I don't know if you know this, but the busiest time in a rabbi's life is right before Pesach. There's a lot going on, especially when you live in and out of town. You know, today, you go to our grocery stores and you get everything from your milk to your cheese to obviously Coke and Diet Coke today, that it's all kosher for Passover. When you live in Phoenix, Arizona, the rabbi's got to go out and do all these things. No more kosher in kitchens. And I get a call from a guy. There's a man coming from Bnei Brak. His name's Rabbi Yaakov Galinsky, Rabbi Yankel Galinsky. And you need to, right now, it's literally 3 days before Pesach. I'm going out of my mind. And he says, well, yes, he's coming, very big holy rabbi. You have to get at least 400 people, rent out a hall. He's going to speak. And you need to raise $10,000 for him. So I said, I can't do it. I said, I can't there for Pesach. I can't. So he says to me, well, he's already there. And his flight arrives, and so I'm stuck. Rabbi Yankel Galinsky was a man of tremendous stature, but he was about this tall. I'm not joking. He actually was saved during the war because he passed through a very young child and he was able to save people. Incredible story. Arsenal printed a book about his biography, if you're interested in reading it, one of the good ones. Anyway, so he came, he's there, okay. Again, it's a long story. But I'm wondering to myself, what does the Ribbono Shel Olam want from me? What does God want from me that right before Pesach, this guy is coming to me? And we didn't rent out a hall. He spoke in the shul. We had 100 people. It was good. He spoke in Yiddish. I translated. I raised $20,000 in 4 hours.
Wow.
I've done that in my life. I'm an old schnorrer. You know, I've collected a lot of money over the years. But, you know, but just meeting the guy. And I'm thinking to myself, what did God want me to learn from this? I lived in North Central Phoenix. If you've ever been to North Central Phoenix, you know that it used to be a citrus grove, grapefruit trees. And the houses are... Anyway, so we're sitting there, and I'm waiting for his ride to pick him up at the airport. He's looking at me, I'm looking at him, and I'm saying... So you know, it was right before Pesach. I said, by any chance, did you recite the blessing on the new blooms that we recite when right before Pesach? He says, no. So he runs out of the house. He says, where are we going? Where are we going? So I said, well, my neighbor has the grapefruit trees across the street. Let's go to the grapefruit. Okay, very good. So we go across the street. And I said, do you know the blessing by heart? He says, no. So we get to sit. So I go back across the street. I get to sit. Yes. He's like waiting. He's so excited that he's going to be able to perform this mitzvah. He says the bracha, Baruch HaTosh, was loud and just with so much pleasure. And then all of a sudden, he wants to smell the grapefruit tree. And he's going, he's jumping. And I went, no. But I mean, he was jumping, trying to get a leaf. And I finally pick off a leaf and I give it to him. And he rubs it and goes, oh, Azoy Geshmak. He smells it again. No, he's got to get another leaf. And he's jumping again. He was 80 years old at the time. He's jumping again. Finally, he gets another leaf, and I get Azoy Geshmak. And he says to me, Zay Main. He says, the nations of the world think, Azay Fashem Vos De'emesahano. They think they understand what real pleasure is. He says, Main, Mir Vesen De'emesahano. We know what real pleasure is. I want to tell you, it was a godly experience to see a human being get such pleasure from the creation that the Almighty gave for us for our benefit. It changed the way I looked at things. He was able to take a grapefruit leaf and he made it into a spiritual experience. How does that happen? Thinking like a Jew. Thinking like a person who, not secular values, not Americans first, Jews second, but I'm a Jew, and part of my American, my part of my Jewish personality is that I have such gratitude for this incredible country. Not picking on America per se. I'm just using as an example. Thinking as a Jew. Thinking, changing our priorities. Truly caring about others. Utilizing this world as a spiritual pursuit. You know, there was a Rabbi Wein told me the story. I'm sure you're all familiar with Rabbi Daryl Wein, a very close family friend. I actually have one of the smichas that I have is from Rabbi Wein. He did me a favor. He tested me in a car on the way to the airport. It's a long story, but I was already a rabbi. I had a number of smichas already. But he said, so I spoke to him. He tested me. He gave me an oral test right there on the spot. It's a good thing it was 45 minutes. If it would have been a shorter trip, I don't think I would be Rabbi Wein. Ordained. But anyway, he's a close family friend. My grandfather, my great-grandfather taught him the Bar Mitzvah parsha. My grandfather was his first Gemara teacher. I mean, we know each other very well. So he once told me the story that when he first came to be the head of the kosher OU organization, so there was a rabbi there who really headed up the thing. His name was Rabbi Rosenberg. Rabbi Rosenberg once told him a story. He said to him, you know, there was a guy who once came in, and he was trying to convince the rabbi that the OU should give kosher supervision to whatever food product he was making. And it was a little bit shady, and he actually insinuated that it would be to the rabbi's benefit, financial benefit, if he would actually get the supervision through. So the way Rabbi Wein told the story is Rabbi Rosenberg was sitting back with his yarmulke like this, an old Hungarian Jew sitting in his chair, steepling. Steepling usually in body language means that, you know, you project greatness. Anyway, so he's steepling and he's going like this, and he says, very interesting. He says, nu, und was sagt Gott? What does God say about this? Meaning, I understand that you want me to give you the supervision, but God also has an opinion. Jews have to start worrying about what God's opinion is. What's God's opinion? What does God want us to do? So, we're still okay for time?
Yep.
We're good. Just a couple more points. Finish off, because it's all about stories. I got a lot of stories. So this basic point was we're starting out as a Jew has to ask themselves, who are we? How do we make decisions? Are we making decisions as Jews? Are we making decisions based upon a culture that we've become assimilated within? How are we making our decisions? The nations of the world don't like us that much, as very evident. Why is that? Either our noses were too long or they were too short. We were too rich or we were too poor. Whatever we are, it was never good enough. Why is it? So one of the names that the Gemara, that we refer to Mount Sinai, is Har Chorev. Chorev, Horev, I'm sure you're familiar with the term. Why? The Gemara says, Ki misham yard echor b'loilom. Because destruction came down to the world from there. Destruction came down to the world? What kind of business is that? God gave us the Torah. We experienced revelation at Sinai. We actually got the better end of the deal. Like, what does it mean, destruction? So the Gemara tells a very interesting story. The Gemara says that when God gave Torah to the Jewish people, the nations of the world, the princes and the kings and the queens, all came to Bilam Arusha. So Bilam, you know, he was the chief non-Jewish prophet. They all came to Bilam, and they said to him, Shema, maybe churban loyelam. Maybe God is just, maybe mabul loyelam. Maybe God is going to destroy the world. Bilam says, no, God promised he's never going to destroy the world. So they said to him, yeah. He said, maybe not a mabul of water, but maybe a mabul of fire. No, God said he's not going to destroy the world at all. So what's going on? So Bilam said, Hashem owes l'amo yitain. Hashem is giving his people Torah. So he said, if that's the case, Hashem yibarech hasamo v'ashalom. The Gemara is telling us a very important ideal here. that the nations of the world perceived Torah coming into the world as the destruction of their world. A world that is based upon survival of the fittest. Listen, before Judeo-Christian values, and I'll just call it that, but before the Torah was given to the world, anybody who is a student of world history knows, it was survival of the fittest. It was social Darwinism. That's exactly what the world was like. There, whoever had the power, kol da'al mugvar, whoever was stronger, that was the person who won. If I had the ability, my influence was my strength. That was the ancient world. And how do we have such a world? Because it's all about me. I have to make sure that I have what I need. I have to make sure that I have enough pleasure, I have enough money, I have enough importance, I have enough power. It's all about me. Torah says, no, it's not all about you. Torah is about taking this world and utilizing it for something spiritual. Taking this world and creating holiness in this world. Holiness, the guy asks, what's holiness? Holiness means utilizing this world for a spiritual pursuit. That's holiness. And when you're focused on yourself, trying to accumulate as much pleasure as possible, it's very difficult to seek holiness, because holiness has to be able to see the pleasure coming through creating something special. Do you ever see these bumper stickers, "He who dies with the most toys wins"? Do you ever see that? It's usually some middle-aged guy with a crisis. Usually back on the back of a Porsche or a Lamborghini. "He who dies with the most toys wins"? I always wanted to say that I want to create a new bumper sticker. "He who dies with the most toys still dies." But that's really the definition of a world without godliness. It's a world without Torah. "He who dies with the most toys wins." The Romans said, "Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we shall die." It's all about accumulating as much pleasure as you possibly can. What Torah brought to the world is spiritual pleasure. An eternal pleasure. A pleasure that lasts. Do you realize that any pleasure, how come you can't remember a pleasure? You can remember that you had a pleasure, but you can't remember pleasure. You can't experience a pleasure now when you think about something that you had a while ago. Nothing physical, you can think about the past pleasures. Something spiritual, you can relive that moment right now as if it's happening. When one sacrifices of themselves to give to another human being, that pleasure, that warmth, that connection that you can feel it now even though it's something that happened before. It means that something that is spiritual is real. Something that is physical is not. So, the nations of the world have a problem with us. They don't understand what their problem is. The problem that they have with us is that we represent true holiness. They can't put their finger on it. We're their nemesis. Our existence basically says what they're doing is wrong. We feel today that we have to talk to them. There has to be a diplomatic solution to all of the anti-Semitic problems. They haven't been able to define the problem for 2,000 years. How is talking about a problem that they've never defined going to bring solutions? The reason that they can't talk about it, the reason they haven't defined it, is because what bothers us is what we represent. We represent God. We represent Torah. We represent holiness. And it's the antithesis to what they believe. The solution is not to become more like them. The solution is to be more like us. We are a light unto the nations, but not by going out there and trying to be a light to the nations. The more we act like the Jewish people, the more of an effect we will have on the people around us. My father, who should live and be well, is a world-renowned lecturer. I'm sure that you all know who he is, but I think he's a world-renowned lecturer. Have you heard of the Discovery Seminar? No? Yeah, my father wrote the Discovery Seminar.
We
had a Discovery here.
Yeah, we had a whole thing.
Yeah?
Yard was great.
My father wrote the Discovery Seminar. So he used to, when we were living in England, I lived in England also. My wife is English. We he used to go to Hong Kong once a year to give lectures to the Jewish Israeli community there. One time, there was a question whether he was going to go, whether he wasn't going to go. He went. But in order to go, he had to stop in Dubai. The travel agent promised him that he's not going to have to get off the plane. It just takes a stop. They clean up a little bit. They refuel, put on, you know, whatever they do. And you'll just go right back on to Hong Kong. From London to Dubai, Dubai. Okay. So he's sitting there in the lounge waiting to board, and a guy comes over to him. 6'6", long blonde hair, huge Australian bush hat. You probably know what that's like. Just came back from Australia, right? So, big bush hat, gorgeous blonde on his arm. Comes over to my father and he says, "Hey, you Jewish?" Didn't ask him if he was Muslim, I guess he wasn't with me. "Are you Jewish?" So my father, who has one of world famous, beautiful beard, flowing, just gorgeous. I did not inherit that from him. Anyway, so he's got this gorgeous beard, and he's got his payas and his yarmulke, and he looks very rabbinical, and he's sitting there, and he looks up at the guy, and he says, "What gave you that idea?" So the guy says, "Hey, good, I want to talk to you. Let me buy you a beer." Okay. So they went into the bar, bought my father a beer, and they're sitting talking. Turns out he's a lieutenant colonel for the U.S. Air Force, stationed in Saudi Arabia. He said to them, "They have all the money in the world, and all they are worried is about you guys. They're worried about you, the Jewish people, about Israel. They have all the money in the world, and that's what consumes them, is Israel." He says, "I know all their flight plans. I know all their secrets. I want to tell them to you so you can give it over to the right authorities. A spy." So after a little bit of convincing, my father said to him, "Listen, I'm not your guy. Right? The embassy," he says, "oh, all you guys stick together. We're putting on a good show, don't we?" Anyway, so all you guys stick together. Okay. So he finally convinced them that he's maybe should go to the embassy or something, you know, the Israeli embassy in London, but I'm not your guy. Anyway, his plane was called, my father's plane was called, my father boards, and he's looking for his seat, and he always gets an aisle seat. Who's sitting there, window middle? The girlfriend and this dude. Now he's absolutely totally bald because he took off his wig and the hat. Okay, for the next 12 hours, he didn't stop eating, swearing, and drinking like the entire time, right? This is like, okay, they land in Dubai. They get on the loudspeaker, and the stewardess says, "Listen, everybody's got to deplane because they got to come and clean up." My father rings the call bell. She comes over. He says, "Hey, listen, I got special permission. I'm not going anywhere." She says, "No, no, no, sir, you have to go." They called out the captain. He said, "Look, I'm Jewish. I'm not going into Dubai." Even though today, actually, Dubai is going not so bad. Back then, it wasn't so good. So, he said, "I'm not getting off the plane." So he said, "Okay,
stay here.
But you have to stay here. Don't get out of your seat." This guy stands up and he says, "If my Jewish friend can't get off the plane, I'm not going either." And my father sings himself like, "What did I do to deserve this?" I don't know, maybe it was the beer. I thought it was kosher. You know, I'm like wondering, like, you know, what could have been going on? Okay, everybody gets off. He's there. He looks at my father and he says to him, "Rabbi, take off your yarmulke. Call the yarmulke. Take off your yarmulke." He said, "Why?" He said, "Because I know these guys. They hate you. Take off your yarmulke. They could, you know, these guys." He said, "Listen, I'm not going to look any less Jewish without my yarmulke on." The beard, the payas, you know, it's taking me away. I'm not taking off my yarmulke. He says, "Okay, have it your way." He says, "Let me get out." Gets out. 6'6", this guy, huge guy. Gets out off. The next hour and a half, he sat there in front of my father like this, protecting him. Okay. Anyway, they sit down, they take off, they're on the way to Hong Kong. Finally, the guy goes to my father, he looks at him and says, "You know what, Rabbi?" And he's waiting, okay, what kind of words of wisdom is this guy? He says, "You know what? I'm glad you didn't take off your yarmulke." He said, "Yeah, really? Why?" He said, "Because I like it when Jews act like Jews and not like us Goyims."
My grandfather used to say that.
Not like us going. we've come to a place where we've always felt, you know, we're going to be more like, we're going to be better Goyim than the Goyim. Where has that left the people who try to be more Goyim than the Goyim? The Arbeiterring, and if you've heard about the Arbeiterring, the Bund, right? When did they have the workman's circle, very leftist, communist Jews, when did they have their annual dinner? Kol Nidreinat. What's left of the Arbeiterring today?
Nothing.
But all those poor little Jewish girls and boys who lit candles with their mother Friday night and made Kiddush with their father and lit the Hanukkah menorah, were there to witness, to see that menorah being lit at Brandenburg Gate, thank you, 80 years after. You know, there was a rabbi, the Ponovitcher Rav, went all over the world collecting money. And he once went to Rome, and he said to his driver, take me to the Ark of Titus. So he said, he walked to the Ark, and he sat there, and he looked at it, and the guy was wondering, why did he want to see this? Because, you know, it's got the whole picture of the destruction of the temple running away with the menorah. Question if they actually did, but the whole menorah up there. And he stood there for 20 minutes, and then he started screaming, Titus, Titus, ich bin da, wo seid ihr? He says, I'm here, where are you? But unfortunately, the Arbeiterring's not here anymore. What's going to be the next generation? The more holiness we bring into our lives, the more we think like Jews, the more we act like Jews, the more of not only the pleasure we have and the meaning we have. Difficult? Yeah, difficult. Who said it was going to be easy? Another thing my father said. Right? But the more of an existence we have, the more of an effect that we have, the more of a chance of creating a legacy that our children, our great-grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, and great-great-grandchildren, my grandfather, who should live and be well, has great-great-grandchildren. He's Baruch Hashem, lives in Memphis, Tennessee. He can look at his great-great-grandchildren, he can say, oh, I recognize him. We want a legacy. We want to bring meaning to this world. We want to show true kindness. We want to have a true experience of pleasure. I like it when Jews act like Jews and not like those things. So thank you very much for listening. It was a pleasure meeting everyone here. And maybe we'll see each other again sometime.
Any questions?
Any questions?
Yeah. It's a real opportunity.
You had a wonderful quote that I tried to catch. The other religions,
Rav Samson Raphael Hirsch said that the other religions were created by man to define God, whereas Judaism was created by God to define man.
Thank you.
I wish it was mine, but
Rav
Samson Raphael Hirsch, who was the head of German Jewry during the 19th century, most part of the 19th century, Frankfurt, Germany. Any other questions? I always like it when I speak so nobody has any questions. Oh, now my mother would really be proud of
him.
Really?
He's great.
He is great.
He's great. Very good historian.
So what are you writing?
What am I what?
What are you writing?
You should know, Rabbi Wein has been on my case for years. I have a book. I have the title, I have all the chapters, and I have a lot of it, but I haven't quite. You know what the title is? Thank you. It's called the title of my book is called Appreciating the Challenge. Because we live in a world where we want to eliminate challenge. We don't want chocolate cake to be fattening. I'm really looking forward to that one. You know, it's the disposable world. We live in a world where we want to make things easier, but in reality, those things that are worthwhile, the challenge is what makes it special. I used to love to cycle. I used to be a very big cyclist. I had a pretty bad accident a couple of years back, so I don't do it anymore. But but I remember that when I would cycle, first of all, I'll tell you when I first started cycling, so I looked like, I want to do exercise. I had an old Bubby bike. Excuse me, Bubby's in the room, but it was a Bubby bike. It really was. It was a bike, and I wasn't really dressed for the occasion, you know. And I had a bell on my bike, I think. It was a heavy old bike, and I was riding, and I would ride, and I thought, and I have a speedometer, and I saw it like, you know, 11 miles an hour. I thought, oh my gosh, that's like. And one of my congregants, one of the members, actually was a categorized cyclist, a Cat 3 cyclist. He was good. And I see him in all this bike gear, you know, and he sees me. Rabbi, is that you? And I'm like, yeah, that's me. He says, let's ride together. I said, I'm going to hold you back. I'm not going to ride together. So he said, no, let's go. Let's ride. So so we started riding, and I really, really was holding him back. I was riding at 16 miles an hour. Do you know what it's like to ride at 16 miles an hour? A heart attack waiting to happen, right, for me. I was like, and I was running. I remember when we were kids, we used to go to the science museum, and they had this stationary bike, and if you ran it really, really quick, it'd like generate electricity all the way to the top. But to keep it there, that was a big deal. I mean, you can't, right? You can't keep it, can't be in the zone all the time. So I was like, and I said, then listen, you go ahead. I can't do it. And then eventually, you know, I got a little bit better, and we would ride with groups, and we could maintain, you know, a riding line of over 35 miles an hour, you know, for an hour straight. But the only way that I got there was by trying really hard, and I learned to love hills, and I learned to love all of the exertion of biking, because every time that I accomplished another stage, I got better. So I wasn't running away from what I wanted. I was embracing that challenge. We have to believe what we're trying to create. At that time, I was trying to be a better cyclist. We're going to be a better Jew. We want to be close to the Almighty. So there's so many opportunities that Almighty gives us to grow close to Him. Appreciate that. Appreciate the difficulty, because it's the difficulty that makes us who we are. You know, a home run hitter, when he gets a 50-mile-an-hour softball thrown at him by a little league guy, it's not much of a challenge. He takes it, right? You ever see the home run derbies, right? So the guy sits there and he throws these balls like this, and they knock it out of the park. But when you get Randy Johnson, who's not a pitcher anymore, one of my favorite pitchers, Randy Johnson used to pitch for the Diamondbacks, 6'10", I saw him pitch complete games, last three pitches, 98, 99, and 100 miles, complete games, right? To hit a home run against Randy Johnson, oh, just give an effort. That was something, right? That was something. That's a challenge. I'm a better batter because I can do that. So it's about appreciating. That's the title of my book. That was a long answer.